Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about the beauty of forests and the importance of protecting them, and about one means by which the government has traditionally protected our forests and how some of those protections could be under some threat. I'm spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with Jim Furnish, who was Deputy Chief of the U.S. Forest Service from 1999 to 2002. We're going to be talking about something which is the Forest Service's roadless policy and the difference that this has made, and the difference that could be made if it were withdrawn or cut back in terms of the kind of protection that it extends to our national forests. Jim Furnish, we welcome you to the morning show.
Yeah, thank you, Greg.
So let's begin by explaining to our listeners what this roadless policy is. And let me kind of spell that, R-O-A-D-L-E-S-S. We look at that intriguing word and can kind of guess what it means, but spell it out for us in specifics.
So let's go back to the beginnings of the U.S. Forest Service in the early 1900s. And over the succeeding decades, one of the things that emerged as a real priority was particularly logging timber on the national forests of the U.S. after World War II to help support the housing boom. Roads are a necessary component of logging. And as we found as the years went by, more and more roads were built to support more and more logging. And the advent of the environmental movement in the late 1900s, this came into sharp conflict. Why was the Forest Service continuing to build roads into these natural landscapes? The Forest Service lost a number of important cases in court, and we found ourselves at a crossroads of really having to try to define what is the future of these roadless lands that had not yet been logged, and as this really related to the whole mission of the Forest Service. It represented an opportunity for the agency to make an about-face, so to speak, and say that there was, in fact, value for these lands as they were, not simply as a source of more timber, but as a source of clean water and wildlife habitat, fresh air, solitude, and now we come to discover forest carbon. So we set about creating a regulation that prohibited further commercial logging and road building in 58 million acres. Now, that's a big number. To put that in context, that was about one-third of all the national forests in the United States, about 2% of the U.S. landscape. So it's a big chunk of land. And then to bring this forward to the present day and why we're talking today, the Tongass National Forest up in Alaska had 9 million acres of roadless lands that were set aside back in 2001. The recent proposal is to eliminate or roll back all of these protections that we afforded nearly 20 years ago. And what does that mean, really, for the forests of Alaska and the roadless question generally?
Right. Specifically, that roadless policy, does it absolutely forbid the construction of any roads or roadways whatsoever? I mean, if we see an area of forest that is designated, does that mean we would see absolutely nothing that would even remotely resemble a road or pathway?
No, we created some carve-outs or exceptions to the rule. So as a general rule, we were prohibiting further commercial logging and road building in these roadless areas, but we recognized that there would be special circumstances that might require occasional road building. And so we enumerated several of those in the rule, and as it pertains to Alaska, there have been 58 exemptions granted in the last 17, 18 years, and every request, every 58 of those requests has been granted to provide exemptions to that policy of no new roads.
So are there other protections in place that, in a sense, specifically prevent logging operations from occurring, or is it enough to simply prevent the construction of the roadways that would be necessary to facilitate logging?
No, I mean, the roadless regulation back in 2001 had an explicit prohibition against commercial logging, again, with certain exceptions that related maybe to emergency fire provisions or insect outbreaks or something like that. But as a general rule, commercial logging and road building were prohibited but for certain exceptions.
So tell us about the recent move in Alaska, or the proposal for a change in this policy in Alaska that has you so concerned. First of all, what forest specifically in Alaska are we talking about? Describe it, and then explain what you believe prompts this proposed change in the roadless policy for this particular forest.
Yes, happy to do that, Greg. This is the Tongass National Forest, T-O-N-G-A-S-S. This is what's called the Southeast Archipelago, a vast landscape of islands and oceans. We would think most notably the larger communities would be Juneau, Ketchikan, Sitka, this area of Southeast Alaska. The Tongass itself is about the size of West Virginia. It's huge. It's the largest national forest by far in the United States, and has about 17 million acres. The roadless portion of that was 9 million. So about half the Tongass was afforded these protections under the roadless area. And it was the source of numerous lawsuits back and forth, the judicial tug and pull of trying to decide what was really just and proper from a legal standpoint after the roadless protections were put in place in 2001. This latest effort came from a petition from the governor of Alaska asking the government, the federal government, to lift these protections for all 9 million acres of roadless in Tongass. And this was supported by the Alaska delegation, which contains two senators, but only one representative. So a very small congressional contingent of three. So when the federal government receives such a petition, they have to act on it. And they have a broad discretion to either just say no, or they can grant the petition in full. So after due consideration over the last 15 months or so, the Forest Service came out with this proposal and said, we will give you what you want, which was lifting the protections on all 9 million acres in question.
Who exactly is in a position to grant such a request? I mean, you said the U.S. Forest Service, but who specifically is responsible for coming up with such a response? I mean, is this at the purview of the director, or is there a body that must vote? Who has the authority to do this?
The petition is received by the Secretary of Agriculture. This is the department that oversees the Forest Service, and the ultimate decision will be rendered by the Secretary of Agriculture, relying on the Forest Service doing all the necessary analytical public involvement work leading up to such a decision.
So what are your primary concerns? Is it so much what will happen in Tongass, or is it the potential ramifications for other forests throughout the country?
I would say there is that lingering concern about the effect this might have on others, but my primary concern is for the Tongass National Forest itself. This is the product of a long, lingering roiling debate about the role of logging on the Tongass National Forest, which used to be a huge program dating back to the 1960s, and has been dwindling ever since. The current timber industry in Southeast Alaska is but a shadow of its former self. Now only about 200 people in Southeast Alaska are directly involved in the timber industry, and yet it occupies a big seat at the table politically. So the Forest Service has been stepping down and down and down the amount of timber that they're providing to timber industry, and they've reached a fairly low level. This latest proposal is to add 9 million acres that, in my view, are absolutely unnecessary. The Forest Service just issued another Tongass land management plan 3 years ago that adequately provided for all the future needs, all the future needs for the timber industry in Alaska. And now we see them wanting to step into this hornet's nest of dropping the prohibitions on commercial logging in 9.2 million acres. I just see this as a really bad idea flying rapidly down a black hole.
We should probably add that I don't believe it is your opinion or the opinion of many who share your specific concerns that there should be no logging whatsoever in any of our forests. I mean, that has never been the position of the Forest Service, but that it rather that it is important that that is controlled and contained. And I think you see this particular move as perhaps a dangerous step in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I'm somewhat sympathetic to timber industry in Southeast Alaska. I actually view a small but reasonable timber industry as helpful to a well-rounded economy in Southeast Alaska. I do think if you go back, say, to the 1970s, I think it was far too large with huge negative environmental consequences. But today, relying on a very much smaller footprint, I think it deserves a seat at the table and enjoys some agency support and help. This, to me, though, is just a tremendously misguided opportunity. This is not the kind of help they need, and I think it's just going to foment further litigation and social and political unrest. Very, very damaging, I think, to the long-term interests of all Americans and Southeast Alaskans specifically.
For anybody who shares your concern or wants more information about this, what would you suggest they do?
Well, the Forest Service has issued a draft environmental impact statement on this proposal. People can go to the Tongass National Forest website. They have all kinds of detail. You can pull up the lengthy draft EIS itself, but it has a succinct executive summary that can be read through, and it also has provisions for making comment. So for those folks in Wisconsin that really feel like they want to weigh in, because after all, you own these lands just as much as anybody else, and provide commentary to the Forest Service to help them assess the wisdom of their choices in the future.
Jim Furnish, retired from 34 years with the United States Department of Agriculture Forest Service and its deputy chief for national forests from 1999 to 2002. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you very much, Greg. I appreciate the opportunity.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. The following interview from The Morning Show archives was recorded back in 2009. I hold in my hands a very interesting and even hard-hitting book about parenting, and you'll get a real sense of the tenor of this book from its title, Your Kids Are Your Own Fault, A Guide for Raising Responsible, Productive Adults. This is a book by best-selling author Larry Winget, and you may know him as a regular guest on Fox News and the author of a number of different books, including No Time for Tact, The Idiot Factor, You're Broke Because You Want to Be, It's Called Work for a Reason, Shut Up, Stop Whining, and Get a Life. We get a real sense of Larry Winget's approach when it comes to tackling some of these issues of life. And so much of what Larry Winget is all about is personal responsibility, about not shifting the blame or the fault to somebody else, but to taking a good, hard, frank, honest look at yourself and what it is that you might be doing or not doing that is contributing to whatever are the miseries at hand. And of course, with this book, we are talking about a call to take much greater sense of responsibility for who your kids are and for what their values are. And as far as Larry Winget is concerned, that really is an incredibly important responsibility of parents, a responsibility which, in his view, is being shirked left and right. And his book is one way he hopes to wake up parents to the reality that they are very responsible for who their children ultimately end up being. Again, the book is called Your Kids Are Your Own Fault, A Guide for Raising Responsible, Productive Adults. It's published by Gotham Books. And Larry Winget, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
One of the things that is interesting about this book is what this book is not. You go into some detail about that right off the bat in terms of trying to dash people's expectations about what you might be trying to do with this book or the kind of things which you are not going to find in this book. Just sketch a couple of the most important things that this book is not.
Well, really, ultimately, this book is not a How to Raise Your Kids book. And I think that's what people are looking for the most part when it comes to parenting books. How do I raise my kids? I really don't care how anybody raises their kids. I don't care whether you get little Johnny Deedy's green beans or not. It's up to you to decide how to raise your kids. This is a what to teach your kid book. My goal is summed up in the subtitle of the book, how it's a guide for raising responsible, productive adults, not kids, adults. What we have to start realizing is that we create the adults that run our businesses and our government and run society. And what we're doing right now is not creating responsible, productive adults. So it comes down to what they know. This book is a book that teaches you what to teach your kids in terms of money and responsibility and everything else.
But it doesn't tell people how to do that.
No, it's a what to teach your kid book. You get to decide the method that you feel is best. I do a good enough job kind of making people's heart beat really hard and making them uncomfortable just talking about what they need to teach. I'll leave the method up to them because ultimately every child needs a different method to get the information into their little heads. So I'll leave that part up to the parent. When it comes to what they need to know, though, that's really my area of expertise. And that really is the key. I don't want to get outside my area of expertise. For many, many years, I've been known as personal finance, personal development, business guy. And that's what I know the most about. I know what it takes to be a successful adult. And so I've taken those elements and shown you should teach those kids those elements in order to have successful adults.
One of the things you come right out and say is this is not a book about fixing your kid. In a sense, does that mean if a parent has been neglecting these lessons, it's a lost cause?
No, it just means that we need to go back to why your kid's a mess to begin with. Kids are a mess because parents are a mess. You don't fix kids. You fix what made the kid the way he is. And in my opinion, it comes back to the parents. So it's not a fix your kids book, it's a fix the way you parent book.
One of the bits of experience to which you can point is that you have two sons who are fine, upstanding, responsible adults. And so you point to them with some pride. One of the things you, however, talk about in your book is being honest that your two sons were not angels. And in particular, the one son, I think, Tyler, who did he go into the Army, I think?
He did go into the Army, and now he's a policeman in Phoenix, Arizona. That's right. Neither one of my boys were angels. And I wouldn't really have the right to write a parenting book if I wasn't a pretty good parent. I'm not saying I was perfect along the way, and my boys were just that. They were obnoxious teenage boys who pushed every boundary and limit they possibly could, and we figured out how to get through it. And a lot of what's in the book is the way I figured it out and what we did and the challenges we faced together and they faced and how we handled them. But if it always comes back to results. My results were good, and so I always look to people who got the right result.
The thing that's interesting is that, for instance, there's a short portion in the book where Tyler talks about you as a father and talks about what he himself was like as a young person. And, I mean, ultimately, I think he completely agrees with you that in the end he turned out really, really well. But he says, in his own words, when I was 18, I was horrible. I was so horrible that I had to leave home to try to figure things out. One of the things I'm just trying to figure out is kind of the harsh reality of those words. I mean, how we kind of fold that into what ultimately is a success story. I mean, should we take from that there was also some problems along the way, or that you made some mistakes as a parent? Or I mean, when somebody's 18, we don't want them looking at themselves thinking they're horrible.
Yes, we do. That's absolutely incorrect. We want people along the way to look at themselves and say, I'm making mistakes. I'm ready to be responsible for those mistakes. One of the mistakes that we make as parents is not forcing children to face reality and forcing them to face their failures and to realize they're making mistakes and they can fix those mistakes. My son was in college, skipping class, flunked out of his first semester of school, had financial problems, made the mistake, like a lot of kids in high school and starting to college, of getting a credit card and messing up and didn't tell me about it. Just made a kind of a mess of things. Was partying too hard at college, doing all those things that typical college kids kind of get stuck doing. And when faced with the reality and what that meant to his life in terms of finances, in terms of work, he had a job that he wasn't showing up for and doing good at and all that. And when you're faced with the reality of what that really means to the rest of your life, he was shocked. And when it got bad for him, he said, I need to get control of my life. And that's when he decided to join the Army. We weren't in a war at the time. I thought it was a good idea. And he became an incredibly responsible person that every one of those things just seems horrible to him at this point.
Right.
You know, when you look back at yourself 15 years later and you go, man, I was horrible. Those were his words. I didn't say he was horrible, but
right.
He said he was horrible.
Right. No, absolutely. Well, and don't misunderstand me. I absolutely agree that sober honesty about who you are and whether or not you're messing up is really important. All I was trying to say is it probably, but maybe you don't agree with this either, it would have been better if at the age of 18 he had learned some of those lessons, which he ultimately learned the hard way. Are you saying, or is he saying, that that's the best way to learn some of these lessons, is the hard way?
Well, I know in my own life I've learned every lesson I ever learned the hard way. In my life, and what's given me the right to write all of these books, is that I can write a book about how to be broke because I did everything in the world to make myself broke and what I did to get through those things. I have to sometimes go face down in failure in order to wake myself up. That's the way I learn. That's the way a lot of people learn. He knew the principles of right and wrong, and I was very good at making sure he understood those along the way. Both of my boys were very responsible children who made typical teenage mistakes. And I think that one of the things we do as parents is we do try to save our children from their mistakes. In this book, I talk about the importance of allowing your kids to understand consequences, communicating that all actions have consequences, and allowing them to feel the pain of those consequences so they can learn from their mistake. Hmm. I think that's what we save way too many kids from.
Right. We're speaking with Larry Winget. We're talking about his book, Your Kids Are Your Own Fault, A Guide for Raising Responsible, Productive Adults. I think one of the points in the book where we really get to the heart of the matter is an interesting list, which is headlined, Why Do Kids Do What They Do? And when we were talking about, for instance, those kind of typical mistakes that a lot of children, including your own two sons, made along the way. And you have a list of, I think, of eight different things that contribute to this. I mean, things as simple as you let them. There are no consequences for bad behavior. But one of them I want you to talk about is you tell your kids they are special. In your view, this is a very serious mistake that parents make all too often. Tell us why this is a mistake or can be a mistake.
Well, I think it is a mistake in that ultimately leads to a sense of entitlement. The fact is, your kid is only special to you. It's not special to the rest of the world. And your kid should be special to you, but they didn't have to earn that. That's just based on them being born. The instant they're born, they're special to you. But they have to be taught that when they walk out your front door, they're just one more little kid. When they go to school, it's going to be about performance. When they ultimately get a job and go to work for a living, it's about what they achieve. All rewards, respect, everything they're ever going to receive in life is going to be based on what they accomplish, not on who they are. And sadly, we've gotten to the point that we've created this huge sense of entitlement where people expect to be rewarded not on their accomplishments but just on the fact that they exist.
Let me ask you about another point in this very same list that I think also for some people listening is going to kind of raise some alarm bells. I want to give you a chance to explain what you mean when you say another, in a sense, mistake that parents make all too often is you made your kids the most important thing in your life. Those are words that on the surface, seem like not troublesome words at all, or it doesn't seem at all like a dangerous thing to do. But in fact, you believe this is a very serious mistake for parents to make.
I do think it's a serious mistake to make your kids the most important thing in your life. I believe your kids are your most important job, but it is your job. When they become the center of your life, and we've seen it way too many times, we see a husband and wife who stay together, and the kids become their sole interest. And your ultimate goal for your child, is to become independent. And so let's say at 18 or maybe after college, 21, they truly become independent and they go away. And then you're left with a man and a woman looking at each other, and they don't even know the other person any longer. They lost themselves and the kids. The only common ground was the kid. Now the kids are gone, and they got nothing in common. Works this very same way in a single-parent family. The child becomes that person's life, the mother's or the father's life, and then they go away. And the person, the adult, the mother, the father, they don't even know who they are any longer. So I think what's important is to understand that as individuals, we cannot lose ourselves in another person. That is your job, to be a great parent, to love your child unconditionally, but not to sacrifice yourself along the way.
Among the interesting things you talk about in your own life and your own experience as a father is the fact that that you and your first wife were divorced, and then you ultimately remarried. And I think you make some really interesting points in talking about that, make interesting points about how, in your view, it would have been a grave mistake and maybe most important, a real disservice to your two sons if you and your first wife had stayed together. And as you talk about that, you kind of discuss the term broken home in a way that I've never really heard discussed before. Talk for a moment about that notion of the broken home and why you discard that term when you describe your first marriage and ultimately the end of that marriage and so on.
Well, I don't believe we had a broken home. We didn't have what some people at the time would have called a traditional home, which ultimately now has become a traditional home in that the parents were divorced. But our home was never broken. It was full of love, and it was full of two parents who loved their kids unconditionally and were willing to work hard together to make sure that they became responsible, productive adults. So our home really wasn't broken. I just lived in a different house than their mother, and then I had a different wife who also loved them in that way. So that it's not like they experienced a broken home at all. They had two places where they were safe and loved and experienced great support so they could be the best kids and become the best adults they could be. I never considered the home broken at all. And in respect to getting a divorce for the kids, I did get a divorce for my children. I did not want them to see the relationship I had with their mother as their role model for what marriage should be about. There wasn't a lot of love between us. There was a lot of arguing. It was all those kinds of things. And that was not the role model I wanted them to see.
In a sense, the broken home was the home when the two of you were still together.
Exactly.
And in a sense, you had more complete, whole homes once the two of you were no longer married.
Exactly. And it worked out to the benefit of my children, I believe. And I'm not saying that's the solution for everyone, but as I've written in some of my other books, sometimes a good divorce is better than a bad marriage. Mm-hmm. No one is served well by a bad marriage.
In your book, you go on to explore what you regard as the five basics of parenting. And, of course, we've heard plenty about these basic tenets, but you explore them, of course, in your own way. The basics of communication, involvement, education, discipline, punishment. I think one thing that is intriguing about the way you lay out this list is that discipline and punishment are very specifically listed separately.
Have a tendency to think of them as the same thing, and in my opinion, they're not. Discipline is establishing a code of conduct, in essence drawing a line in the sand that says this is acceptable behavior, this is unacceptable behavior. And once you create that code of conduct, clearly communicate this is what will fly in my house and this won't, and this, and that, then you communicate the consequences of steering away from that behavior, then you don't have to spend as much time punishing. Sadly, parents think punishing is the biggest part of the parenting role. And actually, if you've done the communication and education, involvement, and communicating that code of conduct and the consequences, you don't have to spend near as much time on the punishing.
Right. And if you neglect the first those first four, then it probably feels like you spend 99% of your parenting time doling out punishment of one kind or another.
Exactly.
Well, once we do get to the matter of punishment, you have a list called Larry's Rules. And again, it's eight different things that you think are important to consider in meeting out punishment to your children. Talk about a couple of the ones that you think are especially important, or maybe ones that might not immediately come to mind for people.
Well, I think the one thing is in dealing with punishment is it has to be consistent. And that means if it's wrong today, it's going to be wrong tomorrow. And it's going to be wrong whether I feel like delivering the punishment, or whether I'm in the mood, or whether I'm sick, or whether my favorite football game is on, or television show is on, or whatever. Consistency is absolutely key. They have to know that when they do something wrong, that the punishment will be the same every single time. Next, I don't believe that you ever punish when you're angry. You know, when you go to court and you're found guilty, they usually have a waiting period between the time you are found guilty and when they sentence you. I think that's a cooling off period. And I think as parents, sometimes we need a slight cooling off period. Because if you're angry and the behavior of the child has been bad and your emotions are high, you may not do the best thing. Which leads to another one in there, is that you have to watch your mouth as a parent. Words said in anger can't be taken back. And I know in my life I've said things that, boy, I wish I had not said that. And I've inflicted punishment that maybe didn't always fit the crime, simply because my emotions were high. So I suggest to everybody as a parent that you not do it when you're angry. and that you give yourself a little waiting time and that you watch what you say, because those words cannot be taken back.
But you also suggest that in number 8 on that list, don't apologize for punishing your child. You go on to say you are the parent. And I think you're, just by including that in this list and the way you phrase that, the implication is that you find there to be a lot of parents in this world that are not comfortable with this part of parenting.
Well, there's a lot of bosses in the world who aren't comfortable firing people for bad behavior, and that sort of goes, it's the same principle. I don't need to apologize to my child for establishing rules and communicating what those rules are and saying, if you do this, then this will happen. I don't need to apologize for having rules that will benefit my child, make sure they're safe and that they grow up well. And when I start apologizing for inflicting the consequences for the behavior, it not only belittles me, but it makes the rule not very significant any longer. So I don't apologize for the fact that they have done something wrong and they have to experience the consequences. I haven't done anything wrong, and I'm the parent. And we've gotten away from the my roof, my rules, and we've gotten away from what I think is still an excellent tool in the area of parenting, which is because I said so. When the kid asks, why do I have to do that? Because I said so. Your family is not a democracy. Your family is an absolute monarchy. You're in charge. Your child doesn't need a friend. Your child needs a parent. They need somebody in charge to guide them, to show them, to tell them what would be the best route for them to take. And when we start making rules and then apologizing for them, we lose all of our power.
Right. One thing you don't go into in very much detail in this particular list, although, I mean, you're close to the matter, is the whole business of punishing by hitting. And, of course, we hear about even parents that go so far as getting out the belt and that kind of thing. You do say don't punish kids when you are when you yourself are angry, which to some extent at least probably addresses that matter. But can you speak a little more specifically to the choices that some parents make in punishing their children?
Well, I do talk some in the book about spanking. I personally think that a quick, well-placed swat on the butt of a kid is not a bad idea. But we have to understand that it should be on the butt, and it should not be the rule in how you do it. It's not your only tool for punishing your kid. It really should be just to get their attention. And I don't think it ought to be done with older kids. I think it's a fast way to get a small kid's attention and to break their mindset from where they are so you can then talk to them. And I don't think you ever ought to slap your kid, ever. I think it's all about just one well-placed swat on the butt. But the sad thing is that parents typically have this one tool in their toolbox when it comes to punishing. I think you have to have a variety of things. I think you have to ground. I think timeout does serve a purpose from time to time. I think as they get older, you have to find out what they love the most and then make sure that you use that, because you have to take away something. It has to hurt them. I remember when my son was I was talking to him and about something he had done wrong, and he said, "Dad, please, just beat me. I don't need a seminar." And so the minute he said that, I realized, and I always knew with him, spanking wouldn't do any good. What he really hated the most was a talking to. So because he hated his seminar and hated to be talked to, that's what he got, because it was the most painful thing I could do to him, was to set him in a chair and talk to him. So when you know your kid, and every kid is going to be different, two boys, two different ways to discipline them, punish them. When you know your kid and you have a variety of tools in your toolbox, and again, you've done everything else right, the time you spent punishing is not, it's not really that big a deal.
At the end of this particular list are these words, and I'm not certain if they're your words or not. I think they maybe are your words. Punishment is not something you do for the child. Punishment is something you do for the child, not to the child.
Yeah, those are my words.
And we don't often hear punishment described in that particular way.
Well, and I think that's a shame. I think we look at punishment as something we do to the kid for being bad. I view punishment as something we do for the child to ensure that they'll be good. Different way of looking at it. I always said that about being a manager, a leader. Aspiring is something you do for the employee, not to the employee. You free them up so they can be in a better place somewhere else. Just a different way to look at it, but when you can start considering that we really do this in order to alter behavior, that is the whole goal of punishment, is to alter behavior in the future. When that's your goal, you start understanding it's actually something for your child.
I want to finish up by asking you about one of your words of warning at the beginning of the book. This is a little bit related to what we talked about at the start, where you wanted to be really upfront about what this book was not supposed to do in your view, or the things you were specifically not trying to accomplish in writing this book. And you have several different words of warning. And I want to just ask you about the third of these four. You write this: I speak in generalizations. I make blanket statements that apply to most people in most situations. There are exceptions. I recognize that. I am fully aware that there are a few situations that there are no exceptions for. So don't bother pointing out the exceptions to me. I don't discount the fact that there are exceptions to every point I make in this book. I just don't intend to deal with them. I like the frankness with which you write those words. But it does sort of point out the can of worms that, in a sense, is opened up by admitting that people are complicated, and the business of parenting is complicated. How do you advise parents out there when it comes then to those matter of generalizations versus exceptions versus should I do this or should I do that? How do you suggest parents kind of make their way through the myriad of choices that they face every day as parents?
Well, I suggest that every single parent, and there are exceptions to everything, and I'm glad you admit that and brought that up. I wrote a book about money, and people said, yeah, Larry, but specifically in there, you didn't address, because I've got an uncle who's sick, and I got stuck with his medical bills, and oh my gosh, there are so many exceptions to everything that could be said. And when you start talking about the way people parent, they have more exceptions to the things that anyone could say than you can imagine. Parenting is a very sensitive issue. So my suggestion to parents is just to look frankly at what ultimately they want their kid to become. My goal, and this is the way I really start the book, is to say design the perfect 35-year-old and work backwards. Have a plan. And of course, along the way, you're going to get off track and you're going to have plans that go awry. That's just the way life is. In every single goal that you set, things are going to come up and get you off track. But when you have a plan and an ultimate goal in mind for what you want your kid to be in terms of responsible, financially secure, educated, have a life based on honesty and integrity, and you want them to be healthy, when you have those goals in mind for your child, it's easy to get back on track. You'll have little days that things didn't go as planned, and maybe a year or two where things don't go as planned. But if you ultimately keep that goal in mind, you can always get back to the big things. It's the big things that are going to ultimately make the difference in that kid's life.
The book is Your Kids Are Your Own Fault, A Guide for Raising Responsible, Productive Adults. The book is published by Gotham Books, and it contains all kinds of thoughts on nearly every single facet of the essentials that Larry Winget hopes all parents will teach to their children. I should just say briefly, one of my favorite moments in the book is where you share with us the answer that was given to you in a Facebook inquiry on the single best thing that your parents taught you. And we have several pages worth of different people sharing the various lessons that they learned from their parents. And as we read these, we realize maybe in a different way the huge difference that parents make, especially when they do a good job with parenting.
Well, that was one of the most fun parts for me to do. I did send out an inquiry on Facebook to I've got 10,000 people out there that read my rants every single day. And I said, what's the best thing that your parents taught you? And what's the one thing you wish your parents had taught you? And the responses were varied. And when you start, as you said, there's so much that parents have the ability to have an impact on their kids' lives just by teaching very, very simple principles. Principles about honesty and integrity. And that's what most of the the great responses were about honesty, integrity, responsibility. You make a mess, you clean it up. Those things, those basic tenets of life that we seem to have forgotten. And in terms of what you wish your kids, parents had taught you, 99% of the responses were about, I wish they had taught me more about money. So I certainly spent a lot of time in the book addressing that.
I'm glad you do. You also, I should say, you really have guts in stepping right out and speaking so frankly on topics where you know full well that a lot of people will probably rise up in arms, I mean, in reaction. I mean, for instance, you say quite forthrightly something about how if it were within your power, you would forbid anybody to marry before the age of 30, and you would make them live together for a year before they got married. I mean, those are words that probably catch most of us off guard, but I get the sense that you mean every word.
I do mean every word. I've seen way too many people get married way too early, and they don't really know who they are, and that's, again, a generalization. Some people are better at 25 than some people are going to be at 45. I understand that. But generally speaking, I think that 30-year-olds, that's about the time you get a good sense of who you are. You've made it through your very beginning jobs, and you're sort of getting secure, and you're kind of getting your finances together, and you're comfortable with yourself. And until you're comfortable with yourself and your finances, you shouldn't think about settling down and tying yourself to another human being. I also think in terms of living together, I don't think you know anybody until you've lived with them for a year and gone through all of the ugly things that just happen between two people who have to go to bed and wake up with each other and clean up each other's dirty laundry and socks and dishes and all that sort of stuff. So I think if we did that, we would have a lot fewer divorces in the future.
Hmm.
It'll never happen. It's just my thoughts on that
right.
topic.
The book includes all kinds of other things, including an interesting list of privileges versus rights, all the things that we need to teach our children are privileges and not rights, and a long list of intriguing do's, the definite do's of parenting, and some don'ts as well. All that and much more in this book called Your Kids Are Your Own Fault, A Guide for Raising Responsible, Productive Adults, published by Gotham Books, and the author, Larry Winget. Larry Winget, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. I have enjoyed this conversation a lot.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll spend a part of the program with Jennifer Sassaman, reconnecting with her and two of her cast members talking about their production of Silent Sky, a really interesting play that looks back at the real-life experiences of a woman astronomer at the turn of the last century and some of the great discoveries that she made, but also the resistance that she met as a woman in a field dominated by men. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Friday, we'll have several different interviews for you, including one on a brand new book about the world of Disney all around the world. A new book has just been published, which follows the Disney experience at places all around the globe through the course of a single day. We'll also be talking with someone from the National Geographic Society about the ways in which they are celebrating women over the course of this coming year. And this weekend, my Star Trek, my podcast on Saturday will feature Star Trek legend DC Fontana, who just passed away. You'll hear a recording that I recorded with her a few years ago. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. Sunny today and a high of 40 degrees, partly cloudy tonight, an overnight low of 26 degrees. Tomorrow, though, cloudier than today with a high of 39 degrees. We do expect dry conditions on Friday and Saturday. Sunday could be a little bit messy with a slight chance of a rain, perhaps rain-snow mix. We're approaching 9 o'clock. NPR's coverage of the impeachment hearings is coming up next here on WGTDH.